Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, hello, hello. Always, always glad to be with you. It's an anchor point of the week for me to be talking with all of you, knowing that there's just a lot of folks out there who really think about things, have an intelligent outlook on what's going on around them, raise questions in their minds, want to help people, want to find the best help for themselves, want to live in a better world, all those good things. It's really a pleasure to meet with you every week and then to have this podcast put up where you can go to it and listen to it anytime you want, as the great majority of the listeners do. So it's just good to be back again with you. For some of you who have been following the show, and I don't remember, since the show was very spontaneous, how many times I've talked about one of the more important things in my life right now, which is my wife's mom. Jean has, by invitation from us, moved from Indiana to live with us. And we've now into about 4 months with Jean, who's 91, and myself, who's 81, and Ginger, who's quite a bit younger than us. And 4 dogs, because she brought 2 big ones along, a collie and a big Sheltie. And living in a new house, which we just happened to have been moving into, not anticipating we would have a wonderful new family. And it more and more draws my attention to the importance of family, to the importance of love, and communicating in a loving, kind, thoughtful manner. And the miracles that can work, and the miracles that's working for the three of us. And it reminds me again of this theme, which I had just begun to really focus on when all of this unexpected gifts arrived. And that is that there should be no monopoly on how to talk to people, no monopoly on counseling. No licensing of whether one person can help a person in another way. No licensing to exclude a person who's good at talking with disturbed people from simply talking with them. And even advertising, I'm good at talking with distressed people if you want to come by and see me. Here are my credentials. Here was what I've learned. Come try me. I really feel that's the only real hope for mental health healing on an outpatient basis in particular is going to be these non-professional, non-trade, non-organized for self-interest groups, but rather people who have learned one way or another through school, maybe not through school, to help other people and who are willing to say, here's my credentials, here's what I do, and here's what I offer, and here's the kind of agreement I make, how much I charge, and so on and so forth. The more I look into it, the more clearly it appears to be the way to go. And I'm going to be working on doing this with Pam Popper, and I've mentioned to you I'm developing a course that we hope to have available in January on the heart of being helpful.
Well, I'll get out of you here.
Now, I'm hearing background sounds. Chuck Knapp, my guest, is that coming from your end?
No,
I'm hearing
it's
a little
not.
Conversation in the back.
No, that's not me.
I think it must be the studio here. I'll send him a message that I'm hearing them talking back there. Well, Chuck, I'm glad you're there. Folks, Chuck Knapp and his organization that he co-founded, Windhorse Community Services, back in 1990, Wind Horse, one word, wind like the wind and horse like the horse, may be the best kept secret in the mental health field today. And talking with Chuck at length on the phone the other night, Chuck, who is, by the way, has a master's in LPC, and we may talk about that later. Chuck has an organization which I believe in its basic approach, while not on the radical edge, perhaps, is on the frontier of helping people. And perhaps because he hasn't promoted himself as a radical edge, he hasn't gotten the attention very much of the reform movement, not nearly enough, nor my attention, because I think what he's doing is really good. And Chuck's last name is spelled K-N-A-P-P. He graduated from Naropa University, which I assume was in Nepal, but it's in Boulder, Colorado, which is perhaps the next nearest thing to Nepal in the United States. And I want to hear about that. He and I didn't talk about that last night because it sounds like an extraordinarily interesting school. And he got a master's in contemplative psychotherapy there. The school was founded by a monk, a Buddhist. And in 2000, he co-founded the nonprofit Windhorse Guild. And this is what he says: in order to promote accessibility to services and collaboration among the community of recovery service providers. He's written only a few things, which some book chapters. Incidentally, I should have had him on a few months ago because he is one of the authors of the forthcoming volume that's coming out of the Journal of Humanistic Psychology, in which for a time I had five or six of the contributors on to advertise this now somewhat delayed Journal of Humanistic Psychology. When it finally comes out soon, I'll make a big announcement about it. But it's going to have a lot of good stuff in it, including a piece by Chuck Knapp. Chuck, I invite you to pick up anywhere about all this, about Naropa, about Ed Podvall, folks, who's a very interesting psychiatrist, who was one of his influences. And to just begin talking anywhere you want about yourself and Windhorse. Well, welcome to the Dr. Peter Brehenhauer.
Thank you, Peter, for that introduction. And really interesting also to hear the way you brought life in, your life, as it's working right now in your home and with your mother-in-law and all. And I think the Windhorse originated, I think, by the urge to bring, mental health and recovery and compassionate urges towards folks who needed some kind of safe place to be and some place to establish life, you know, to get it out of institutions and institutional settings and into the home. This was in the early 80s when the approach first started. And Ed Podvall, as you mentioned, he'd been psychiatric director of Chestnut Lodge, so he'd had a whole lot of inpatient experience with folks. And he certainly could see, you know, that there were benefits in ways to that for a lot of people. But, you know, there are some serious downsides pulling a person out of their life, out of just, you know, normal, meaningful kinds of relationships with people with relatively stable minds and bring them together with other people whose minds weren't all that stable. And sometimes the compounding effect of that confusion, being all together like that and out of kind of meaningful context of life. So he, I think he took certainly inspiration from the downsides of that, and also Chogyam Trungpa, who started Naropa, he was encouraging us all to not get too proud of how we had a relative sanity going, in the world. You know, we were all meditating looking at our minds and really starting to see this broad spectrum of how our minds worked, and that, you know, I didn't really, when I was with people who were having extreme state issues, I could easily see that part of my own mind. It's just a matter of degree and balance and trying not to just create a situation of other that was so prevalent in the system at that time. All of us who started this back in the day, we had experience in the mental health hospital work and mental health centers and all that, and it was a pretty rough system to work in, both if you were a client or if you were a staff person. So we were all looking for some way to bring a more compassionate and earthy approach to working with people as people, and, you know, not different, just people with different needs. And anyway, that came out of Naropa in the early 80s.
It's such an important concept, and I'm sure over the eons it has surfaced in different ways. I remember in college, most of the good reading I did in college, even though it was Harvard, was stuff I picked up at the bookstore and not my courses. And one of the things I came upon was Martin Buber's I and Thou, which is, he's a theologian talking about human relationship in terms not of other, but of I and Thou, where you the so-called other is actually sacred, that you're sacred. All of us are sacred, and that the other is sacred and has to be related to with great reverence. And so many people have thought about these things, and we've had such a terrible time keeping anything remotely like it going in the mental health community. And I'm so glad that you're there. And tell us some more about it. I'm so glad it has a family orientation whenever possible. That you work, you actually have teams that go out into the family from what you were telling me the other night. We never got to finish talking about it. I'd be very interested to hear about that.
Right. Well, one of the things that I think is a real key element here is that everyone is so completely distinctly different, and their families are all completely distinctly different. We work with people. I mean, we have done work with folks, you know, in their teens, and then this certainly works really well with late stage life issues too. And we've done a lot of elder care work, but most we work between usually about ages, you know, 18 and 65. And a lot of the people are still younger in their, you know, in their families or dependent on their families for support, and haven't really emancipated. And so, and these are also, I mean, I can't say this, I don't want to repeat myself, but I also, everybody's just so different, and every family's so different. So, for instance, about half our people are from out of state, and you may have families that are together, you know, like mothers and fathers that are together and their son or daughter's here, or they may be divorced, whatever. They may be getting along really well. They may not have harmonious relationships in the family. So when somebody comes in, you know, you don't know, you know, we help them establish a home here. The family, again, may be away. They may be on site. But we try to tailor the situation very specifically to this person who's the client. And sometimes, you know, we have teams. Let me just start building the team here a little bit. And there are five roles, principal roles on a team. For a fully developed team, there'll be a person, actually a staff person, in the housemate role who will live in the house with the client. And they're not there as a counselor or a therapist or anything like that. It's just really a more of an ordinary housemate arrangement, just trying to keep a good, basically well-running house with good rhythms and a good environment, a good kind of clean rhythmic environment. And also that's a very significant relationship, obviously. It's a very kind of intimate role. You know, you share a kitchen, you clean the house together, you negotiate the space of a house. And then there are people that we call basic attenders who come into the house, come in and meet the client oftentimes in the home or someplace in the community. But it's another pattern of relationships that help with just starting to get back into life. Oftentimes people, when they come here, they may be pretty isolated. They may also not be doing things in life that have been really sustaining and you know, kind of a sense of their health and connection to the world. They may have gotten really disconnected from a lot of that. So through the basic attendance and the contact with these basic attenders, folks start back into getting out in the world, trying to, you know, get your eating and sleeping, eating and exercise going, attend to the house, keep a good house, and just real basic life, you know, and as time goes on, getting back to work, getting back to school, that kind of stuff, but establishing a pattern of relationships and activity. Psychotherapy, frequently part of the mix, that's another role here, and team leader is part of the basic attendance crew, kind of helps coordinate the whole thing. And then the team supervisor is really attending the whole environment. And it's with the team supervisor is the person who's usually working with the family mostly. Try to oftentimes kind of separate the roles, a little separate the parents from the household, just because oftentimes it's really simplifies the relationships that the client is forming with the team that's more on site and active with them. And sometimes the family work can be very specifically, can look really like family counseling and having meetings that focus on all sorts of issues that are important to establish, you know, how we're communicating, how everybody's communicating with each other, issues of how money works, freedoms, encouragements, getting the distance right between the parents and the son or daughter. Sometimes it's not at that stage where you can work like that. And so in a best case scenario, if the problems have been on hand for a long time, it takes a long time to come out of that. And, you know, most of the work we do is really unusual for us to work with somebody for less than 6 months, and it's most common for it to be at least a year, two, three, 4 years, depending on the issues. And so over time, the client is developing all kinds of different relationships with the team. And that includes a certain amount of relating to some of the older people on the team, like me, very much in parent roles. I probably sometimes in grandparent roles, I suppose. But there's quite a lot of practice that goes on in relationships of all sorts, from peer type relationships to parent type relationships in the team itself, and then as a team supervisor, really trying to be. Come alongside and partner with the parents and over time figure out how the changes that are happening within the team and the client can actually be supported and matched with the changes that the family is making as well. And I said a lot there. I hope that made sense.
Oh, gosh, it all makes complete sense. And, I mean, the thing I don't understand is how little is you've been in the limelight of the folks I work with. I've just always heard this term Windhorse in the background. And also Ed Podville, the psychiatrist. I heard about him years ago, but never made a connection. Tell me, if somebody here wanted to call about a family member and they can find Windhorse very easily, no other confusing names, no other names to be confused with it when you Google.
Right.
And just called you, and who would they get, and what would happen?
Okay. And just to clarify, there's the Windhorse originated in Boulder, and then another center started in Northampton, Massachusetts, that's still going, and there are two more on the West Coast, one in San Luis Obispo and one in Portland. And then there are three or four centers in Europe. So they're around. And but let's say you call Boulder. One of the things that we've done here, because it's such an unusual approach, and as I said, you know, yesterday when we were talking, that so many of the people that do come to us, they've been in some form of treatment or another for oftentimes for a while, and so their terms of thinking tend to be educated through a Western lens, and frequently that's a more of a mainstream psychiatric lens. There are also people that certainly come here who have really just not wanted any part of that, and you know they know that they're fundamentally good people, you know, people that have some quality of worthwhileness, but they're not finding a sense that in the mainstream. And I'm not trying to knock mainstream at all. The place is full of really good people doing all kinds of good things. I know that it's really hard to connect with for a lot of the people that come to us. And they come here looking to just settle in and to not feel like a problem, that we're just, all we are now is a diagnosis and a kind of a matrix of problems to be solved. So they're looking to be in relationship. So back to admissions and what happens when you contact admissions here, we have really some of our most experienced people that a new caller will come into contact with, because we realize that you have to have the ability to really hear what's going on with somebody and to be quite bilingual, so to speak, in hearing the language of the family, the language of the training and experience that they've had in their experience with whatever you know, treatments and life that they've had so far, and then how do we meet that? So it's just like with a team, it's a very individually tailored process of trying to really hear who these people are, what's going on, and see if there's a possible fit. And we always try, if it's not a fit, we always try to help folks understand other resources that we may know of that could be useful to them.
Now, your support for this wonderful program, does it come in part from insurance payments, or is this covered under Medicare, Medicaid, regular insurance programs?
It's primarily private pay. And
I mean, no insurance, you mean? By private pay?
We definitely can bill and do bill in a way that codes for insurance. But insurance companies typically only want to reimburse for psychotherapy and not a lot of the basic home level support. So it's a relatively small percentage of what we do is usually covered by insurance.
Right. I would expect that.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Medicaid.
That's
Medicaid,
part of the system again, which is supporting the professions, supporting the trades, not the best approaches, which always looks something like yours. I mean, all the best approaches, Soteria House, where people come into a small, very small residential community, so successful. Even like the highly professionalized Open Dialogue that's being spread around a bit out of Finland. It's a team going into the family instead of bringing the family to them. So, I mean, this is what should be getting supported.
It's true. It's really true. And probably the only times that insurance companies really embrace what we're doing more fully is when somebody they've worked with has been, just costing them tons of money, and then they'll start looking at us and going, okay, maybe they can help out. And usually once a person comes into our system, we have a good ways of being able to help things settle down and being able to help a person keep their life together in a way that hospitals start being so in play. You know, you if anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And the hospitals
Yeah.
are so expensive.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And the Medicaid and Medicare, those are tough systems to work in, and some of those contracts, you know, the big contracts that get really negotiated for communities go through the mental health systems themselves. So we're not part of that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Talk about the one of the issues that I'm interested in, as you know, and a lot of folks out there listening now will be interested in, is the role of psychiatric drugs. What was Ed Podvol's view of that? That's Podvoll, Ed Podvoll.
Podville,
And
yeah.
Podvoll? Pod, like it really
Podball,
looks. Podvoll.
yeah. Podball.
I should know that from podcast. Podvoll.
Yeah, right. That's
What were his views on medication, and what are your views on medication? And obviously, folks, they're not pushing drugs, or I wouldn't be happy about bringing them on. But try to discuss your position on it, which to me sounds pretty reasonable.
Okay. All right. Well, you asked about Ed's position on it. He really didn't like them very well. Really didn't like the effect they had on people's consciousness, and the fact that so much of the time, the way they were used, they impaired a person's awareness and consciousness in a way that actually prevented recovery. Prevented getting back into life in a way, and at the same time, so he spoke from his heart in a way that had a lot of kind of pain around this and frustration actually, and at the same time he did use medications, but he tried to use them in as sparing a way as possible, and he always tried to help a person understand how to come off of medication if they could. He had a good disciplined approach to that. That was part of the whole kind of way we started working with people. And back to the point about, you know, not one approach really working for everyone, we've had a lot of people here who have been able to work on minimal or no medication, and a lot of people who find that they actually want to work with medication, and that seems to work best for them. We've had a very open approach to that, and it's very tricky territory, obviously. You know, I was at a conference about 3 years ago, and there was a speaker who was speaking quite adamantly against the use of medication. And after the talk, I don't know why this woman came up to me. She was in her early 30s. She said, "Whenever I hear somebody talking like this, I feel like such a failure." She said, "I'm a school teacher. I have tried 4 or 5 times now in really disciplined ways to come off medication and be off medication, and I always end up in the hospital." And so she said, "I manage on a very low dose." There was no, in my experience of her, there was no obvious impairment or effect that the medications were having on her in terms of clouding her affect and, you know, consciousness. But she said, "I haven't been able to figure out how to do this." And I know a lot of people. I'll be, let's see, on and off of our staff who do and don't, and have explored being on and off medication, and on and off in our community as well of clients and family members, that it's depending on the conditions of their life and the levels of stress and how much attention and time they can devote to self-care. And there's a broad range of how medications are used here.
Now, are most of your people chronic so that they would very likely come? They've been just struggling and been medicated, so they're likely coming on meds?
A whole lot of people come here on
Yeah.
medications, that's right. And
So
then they're definitely
let me
go ahead, dear.
just offer some thoughts about it. In my experience, it can be very difficult to help people come off meds who have been on them for many, many years.
Yep.
And if they're not motivated, then not only would it be hard for them to come off, it would be unfair to to push them. I think what you do is you educate folks and let them do what they want to do. Now, if somebody calls you on the phone and says they want to come, but they don't want to do meds, and they either want help coming off or they don't want to be started, would you respect that as a as their condition for coming?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
See, and I think that makes you unique right there. And one of the reasons why I'm very accepting of what you're doing is that it is difficult when people have become committed to diagnoses and medications to help them without going along with what they're committed to. So you're just not going to help them at all. You know, if you tell them they can't come, if they aren't devoted to coming off their meds. And many people are unable to get off their meds after being many years on them and so on. So I'm not at all objecting to the fact that you're willing to give medications. I do hear that you're reluctant to. Is that a fair statement? And that you're utterly accepting of people who want to do it without drugs.
Okay, reluctant I wouldn't say reluctant. I would say if a person comes here and they're on medication or, you know, they're in the hospital and, you know, they may, boy, this is tricky territory. I don't have any resistance to a person using medication if that's what it seems to be indicated or that's what they want. And I have no resistance to them coming off of them either. It's really an open situation that way.
Yeah, see, that's where you and I would be different. Because first of all, everyone who comes to me knows that I, at the least, don't encourage medication and that I don't start anybody on medication. So everybody who comes to me is in agreement with me. And if they call me on the phone and have never heard of me, I tell them my website and I say, let me tell you a little about me, just a minute or two. And if that interests you, that's fine. And a surprising number of people say, yes, I didn't even know that anything like that existed. When can I see you? Other people say, well, I want to think about it. And I say, well, go look at my website and take a look. So you and I come from a different direction in that regard. And I'm okay with that, folks, because they are doing good work with people and offering people who ask for it and want it an opportunity to work without medication. And I think that's very positive. If I were at this your organization, I would probably be more proactive on telling people the hazards of meds. But I don't think you know, what the science is. But I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on that, because I think it's important that you exist, and I'm very glad you're doing what you're doing.
Thank you. And Peter, let me say, I think it's fantastic that you're out there and bringing the science and the opportunities and the knowledge to people. It's such an unavailable resource for people to actually go to somebody who understands the territory and can help them think about this. I'm so appreciative of that.
Well, good, good.
Yeah.
Tell folks how active are you? How many people do you have? And I have a question, both staff and patients. You have the most extraordinary patient-staff ratio I've ever heard of, and in a good way. And also, I mean, if you get 10 phone calls from this radio show, do you have 10 spaces? How do you work in that way?
Okay. We have run for the last 10 years probably. We've been having a staff, total staff of between 70 and 85 people, something like that. And our clients and families have been between 70 and 85 people. So it's just about a 1-to-1 ratio. Sometimes let's see. We've been running typically pretty full, but we also manage to bring people in. You know, it's just, you know, there's enough turnover in that number of folks that we manage to be able to bring in a person or two per month as needed. So But 10, yeah, that would be hard.
Well, you better call fast, folks.
Yeah.
Do you feel, I never asked you, and you may wish to just leave it for your own conversations with people who call, but it's got to be expensive to maintain that kind of staff giving services to folks. Can you talk about the costs, what it costs to come to your organization, or, and I think it would be perfectly fine if you want to just leave that open to people calling you.
Right. Let me speak to it in general terms. Because I think it's still tailored. We can set up a team that's really ready to bring a person out of the hospital where they've been in a highly structured environment. And while costs are high, they're not nearly as high as them actually being in the hospital, especially a hospital, like one of the big, national hospitals like Menninger's, something like that, where a lot less money than that. But at the same time, it's costly because we have a lot of staffing, and we try to the training for the roles build, like a basic attender learns that to become a team leader. Team leaders become psychotherapists. Psychotherapists become team supervisors. So a lot of our staff have been around here for 10 to 25, 30 years, and the older folks. And so we also need to pay them reasonably well so they don't just kind of float through here and then go on to something else. And so we try to have highly trained people who've been here for a long time. And when a client, a family come to us, we're really trying to assess what the needs are again. And most people can't use really a huge team. So we try to tailor it down so you get the right amount of contact and get the costs down. And about a third of the people that are with us at this point, we're working with, their cost per month is more like what it would be for a person in weekly psychotherapy, like with a well-paid professional.
That's amazing if you can do that.
Well, yeah, I mean, part of it is, some of these people that are in that position started with big teams, and they're on their feet in the way. They're connected with local resources, working, being in the community, and they don't need the help they used to. And then some people actually start small like that. And we're really conscious of that for people who haven't made a good connection and good relationships with a therapeutic situation, we're really aware that to develop a good connection, good strong connections in the beginning is very important. And then over time, helping everybody find their way into just the normal community, so that they're not dependent, overly dependent for too long on our situation. But, if people move at their own pace. We have employment services. We help people find work in the community. There's all kinds of different ways we help people get connected out in the community beyond the team.
Chuck, and folks, we're talking with Chuck Knapp, K-N-A-P-P, who is the co-founder of Windhorse Community Services. Did you draw at all on the wraparound services model? Folks, one of the best approaches to helping people stay out of hospitals, come out of hospitals, and get great services that end up being far less expensive to the community than mental hospitals and jails are wraparound services. And the way they work when they've been employed is the state or the county puts aside a certain amount of money for families that are costing the state a great deal, and where it looks like one of the children's going to spend his whole life in mental hospitals and jails, for example. And they provide a complete package of family services. It may cost $100,000 the first year. In the long run, it's going to be really less expensive. And it'll involve social workers, teachers from the school, and a variety of other inputs, many of these professionals already being paid that are coming in and out, so they don't cost them anything. And they worked very well. I consulted for about 10 days to one in Alaska that had been developed because it was so expensive for them to send people from Alaska down to Texas and other places that could handle very, very difficult young people. And of course, none of these ever last for lengths of time because they undermine professionalism. They undermine the guild system. They undermine forcing people into hospital and private practice or clinic settings that are that support the well-being of the provider far more than they support the well-being of those being provided for. So again, I think that this has a wraparound sense to it. And were you familiar with wraparound, or is it just that good things go in the same direction?
This did not come out of that. I learned about wraparounds probably about 15 years ago, I think. So we'd been well underway with this by then. But they certainly, I think, share some of the same efficacy, you know. There's something, I just to note, I'm one of three co-directors here now, and we're all getting ready to retire and looking to kind of transition this to another generation of leadership. But one of the co-directors that's retiring is looking to set up a clinic that uses Windhorse principles, and I think it will incorporate a bit more of the wraparound teamwork in the community, and probably especially with the there's a really good homeless infrastructure here in Boulder, and helping people get housing and back to work and that sort of thing. And I think I shouldn't be talking about this too loudly, I suppose. It's being worked on. But I think the wraparound view and complementarity is something that we're going to try to rouse here to help extend these services to people who can't afford them as they are.
Right. Why do you want to retire?
Oh, well, I'm not going to retire. I'm not going to retire actually as a clinician, and I like to write, and we're starting a blog, and I'm you know, kind of heading that up. And so I have lots to do, and you know, if we don't let another generation of people do this, they're going to get old pretty soon and won't want to. Which is kind of an interesting point, because you may know of a conference that's been going on the West Coast, Lang in the 21st Century, and I first went there about 3 years ago, and there were a lot of people there from alternative type communities, but the alternative, these communities had rose up, flourished, and then died with the charismatic founders.
Yes, exactly. And they also got suppressed. So I think you're talking about a very important principle.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
All that, the suppression, the conditions changed. It would be hard to start this now, the way things are right now. It was much easier back when it was all sorts of things were looser, I think. But my point was, we managed to outlive our charismatic founder, and mm-hmm. now we've had a chance to be in existence long enough that we're actually exploring more about how to create a therapeutic community, you know, clients, family, and staff that bring Windhorse community, Windhorse principles more into the actual community itself, and which supports the teamwork. You know, so many mental health organizations, they have a business model that's more of a kind of a straight business model, and especially if they start getting really profit oriented, and ours has never been a profit, or it's a for profit, but it's not a profit oriented. It's much more of a nonprofit sensibility, and trying to create the community atmosphere in such a way that it really supports the work of the teams and the people, the staff doing the work, but the clients and the families all being just part of the mix. So it's really a privilege to be able to have been in this for as long as we have, and I hope to stick around after I retire as a director, co-director.
Good.
They'll have me.
Good for you. I mean, there's nothing more satisfying in life than helping people, at least from my viewpoint. And I plan to work as long as God lets me, and until little children run from the room in fear when they see me. And that doesn't seem anywhere near happening. I still seem to attract the kids when I just walk down the aisle of a restaurant. So the little ones
Very
just
good.
Look up and like, hey, I know you. And I look at them like, I know them.
Yeah. people know people, don't they?
Well, yeah, there's something that goes on about all of that. And God knows where that would take one in wondering about the universe and communication and how people communicate. But that would take us far afield. What other things would you like folks to know about Windhorse? Well, one thing you did say that I want to remind folks is that mental health does not necessarily progress over time. It's too tied into the political system. And I would agree with Chuck that many innovative things were much more possible years and years ago than they are now, and even centuries ago, when we had the era of moral therapy in the 17 and 1800s. So right now, the society is being so industrialized and so profit-motivated and so organized around guilds, you know, the psychiatric guild, the social work guild, whatever guild, that the delivery of services really is toward the person providing them, unfortunately, in the services of power, authority, and money. I don't think I've actually said that clearly as I have today about that the services actually are for the server. And that's backward. Doesn't work. It's not good. Doesn't help people.
Right. Yeah.
I'm sure that makes sense to you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a term that came to mind as you were talking was industrialized mental health. I was reading Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, some years ago, and he used the term industrialized. I think industrialized food was the term he used. And I thought, oh right, we're in a period of industrialized mental health right now as well, and it's pretty hard to you know, the way the education is working and the way the funding is working, it's pretty hard to find a way to do something like this in this environment. But there, one of the things that I think there's a lot of people wanting something different, and it's not very available. And that was one of the things that I found so inspiring about this conference, the one I mentioned earlier, the Lang in the 21st Century conference, was there's a bunch of people coming together who are part of the alternative world, who have been part of these communities and are still trying to, you know, work in wherever context they're in, and to create context and to network. And that's been part of the spirit of this blog we've started called the Windhorse Journal. We just started it. It's to share principles of that we've learned over the years, and also to just try to help people who are interested in something other than industrialized mental health have a place to listen in and contribute themselves. So,
These are tough ideas for people. Gosh, I've never mentioned any of this personal on the air, probably, but I've been trying to sell a book that has four or five great chapters. It's called The Martyrdom of America's Child, and it's about the industrialization of our children, their food, their education, their mental health services, their violent video games, their social media, which separate them from their families and from adults and give them private and not healthy communities of their own. And I have not been able to get an agent or a publisher interested in it. So I've never suggested this before in my years and years, but if somebody out there is an agent or publisher who wants a book that's going to take a real look at this industrializing of our children, what we're doing to them, and of course, the spinoff is it's happening to the adults as well. Give me a call on my public telephone. I'd love to hear from you because I'm stymied at the present moment on how to get some interest in this book that I think is many people are beginning to think this way, but publishers represent always to some extent some kind of establishment, and people don't want to look at this terrible industrialization of food and drink and education and healthcare and psychological services and so on. It's just a huge thing. And you're defying that. Windhorse is really defining the industrialization, and you're looking at the family and helping the family, which is what people most benefit for when that's available. Even if they're grown adults, they're going to benefit more from you helping their whole family than just from you helping them. Deeply believe in what you're doing.
Yeah. By the way,
I think if
Peter.
I hadn't been stuck in professionalism, I would have very early on just started visiting families at home. I maybe I'll end up doing that someday. I'd work at their homes instead of in my office.
Right. It's so lovely to do that. By the way, I just want to say the book you're describing is it's so important and it's so horrifying. You know what you're, I just, I, you know, that's a whole track to we could, I'd love to hear what you have to say about that. If
Oh,
you're.
so that's interesting. So you think maybe the resistance is actually that it's plain horrifying to think about.
Oh, it's utterly horrifying, and the momentum, obviously,
Horrifies me and Ginger for sure. Yeah, go ahead.
yeah, the momentum is not going in the right way, particularly, although there are a lot of people who are, I know, working to wake up in the midst of this and to not just be flushed downstream in kind of a mindless absorption into that kind of momentum. So,
Yeah,
but got a voice
absolutely.
like what you're talking about to I look forward to, I hope you can get this out.
Well, I can self-publish, God willing, and if I have the energy, but this book deserves, some sort of imprimatur on it that's going to help it get outside the circle of reform-minded people. Now, we've got about 7 minutes left, 6, 7 minutes. I want to make sure we're covering the questions people may have. Do you ever go here? Let me give you a one of the sort of code word questions that reformers ask. Do you ever get involved in involuntary treatment of anybody?
Oh boy.
Oh boy.
Let's see.
I promise I won't stop talking to you.
Well, let's see. I'm it's pretty unusual. The only people I've worked with since, middle 80s, I've had a little bit of, I did a little bit of individual private practice back in the 80s, but I wasn't interested in it, and I was actually going to leave the field until I found Windhorse, because I know it's valuable for people, but I just don't think that way. And when I came across Windhorse work, and Ed Podwell was a good friend of mine, this is like, oh, I think this way, and so I've spent all this amount of time working with people who tend to be in living in at least episodically and sometimes for decades at a time in pretty difficult positions, and you end up with folks sometimes that are really on the cusp of something going on that's really out of control, dangerous, or just lost somehow, like. I could give examples, but I kind of don't feel like
No, there's
being
no
that.
reason to go there. So some of your people might be involuntarily outpatient committed. Have you ever worked with anyone in that position?
Yes. And the only time we go towards involuntary, I mean, I go way totally out of the way to not do something like that. I think the last time that happened was I had a young man who was young woman, excuse me, in a not on medication, so far into a particular state of mind, and this person was doing magic and invoking elements, and it just flooded a third floor apartment, and getting ready to burn the place down, invoking fire.
Let me say a word about my own feelings about this, because there may be folks might be a little surprised by what I think. Well, first of all, probably as anybody could guess, I've not committed anybody or certified anyone during my entire career since I left my training in 1966. I just don't do that. I find other ways to help and so on. But in recent years, I have decided not to deprive people locally who were under outpatient commitment and who wanted to see me so they could have a psychiatrist who wouldn't insist on their having drugs as part of their fulfilling the involuntary commitment and getting them out of the involuntary commitment. I think it's only like one or two people. And I've also worked with people, I think it might just be that particular scenario might be just one person. And a few people who have been under court order, not under involuntary commitment, but there's a part of, say, they're being on probation that they had to have therapy. And I've also worked with them under the condition that I only would confirm they were coming, that I wouldn't say a word about them. I'd only confirm that they were coming because that was a requirement without which they couldn't see me. If I didn't send them a bill or something to show they were coming to see me. So it's a complex world. Chuck Knapp, we're pretty much finishing up now. I'm so glad you've been on. You know, I'd like to have you on again as you think more and more about these issues. I think the work you're doing is really important. I would invite you to take a look at my website, that's about services, and it's called empathictherapy.com or .org, and see if you'd like to add your name and a description of your organization to the listing there. I'd love to see you up there and maybe a mention of your network around the country or the world. And then send it to me and we'll put you up as a resource, because there's hardly anybody around like you and as good as you. So thank you, Chuck Knapp, for being on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. Thank you, my wonderful audience, for listening and caring. Bye-bye now. Bye, Chuck.
Thank you, Peter.
We'll be in touch.
Thank you so much. Okay, bye. Bye-bye.